Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our fourth and final showcase panel. I'll give everyone a moment to settle down and find a seat here, and then we'll get started in just a second. Wonderful. Welcome, everyone. My name is David Hongs, and I'm the president of the Yale Student Chapter. And it's my privilege today to introduce the moderator of this panel on science in the courts after COVID and Scrimeti. That moderator is Judge Jennifer Mascott. Judge Mascott is a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, a position to which she was confirmed this past October. Before joining the bench, Judge Mascott was an associate professor of law and director of the Separation of Powers Institute at Catholic Law. Before joining Catholic Law, Judge Mascott taught at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School, where she was an assistant professor of law and co-director of the C. Boyden Gray Center. Professor Mascott wrote in the areas of administrative and constitutional law, theories of constitutional and statutory interpretation, and the constitutional structural separation of powers. She also served as a Supreme Court contributor for NBC Universal. Her scholarship has been cited extensively by the Supreme Court and other federal courts. And in addition to scholarship, Judge Mascott has also engaged in public service as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel and Associate Deputy Attorney General. Judge Mascott is a former law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas and to then Judge, now Justice, Brett M. Kavanaugh. She graduated summa cum laude from the George Washington University Law School, where she earned the highest cumulative graduating GPA on record. Please join me in thanking Judge Mascott for moderating this panel.
Thank you so much for that warm introduction. And I cannot say how much of an honor it is to be here and be able to moderate this final panel. Hasn't this conference been great so far? I mean, what a smashing success for new FedSoc President Sheldon Gilbert's first year. I could not be more impressed, and it's just been so great to be with so many of you. And just one more round of applause for Sheldon and Dean and the whole team. Okay, so consistent with the theme of the conference being new legal frontiers, this final panel is going to address science in the courts after COVID and Scrimeti. And it might sound surprising or niche, but I think that we'll find as we talk with our experts, expert litigators and scholars, that the issue of science in the courts, expertise, what role does science or general expertise have in policymaking, in legislating in the courts with administrative agencies, is potentially a very impactful topic and can have a lot of applications, and how courts and the executive branch handle science could really have impact in how cases come out. And so it's important to think through as litigators and those who are trying to intellectually shape the law and practice the law, think about whether and to what degree science and expertise in general has within our constitutional system. So I'm going to just start off by introducing our panelists, and then they are going to introduce the topic more generally. What we mean here for purposes of today when we talk about science in litigation or in the courts, and what proper role it has. So we're going to be, we're blessed and honored to begin with Ben Flowers, who is a partner at Ashbrook Byrne Kresge Flowers, LLC. Before joining the firm, Ben was the 10th Solicitor General for the state of Ohio. He regularly represented Ohio before the Supreme Court, the Sixth Circuit, and the Supreme Court of Ohio. And most prominently, maybe famous case that we all know and potentially listen to oral arguments in, hopefully, NFIB versus Department of Labor. Ben led a multi-state challenge to OSHA's vaccine mandate, ultimately prevailing before the Supreme Court. Ben's a graduate of The Ohio State University, the University of Chicago Law School. He clerked for both Judge Sandra Okuda on the Ninth Circuit and for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. After he gives some brief remarks, we're going to hear from J.J. Snydow, who's a partner at Keller Postman and specializes in civil litigation in trial courts. His practice focuses on product liability, consumer protection, and antitrust law. Previously, he practiced in D.C. at Wilkinson Steckloff, a defense side trial firm, so he's seen things on both sides. He graduated from Harvard and Yale Law School. He clerked for Judge Kethledge on the Sixth Circuit, Judge Thapar on the Eastern District of Kentucky at the time, and Justice Anthony Kennedy. He was formerly chairman of the Federalist Society's Emerging Leaders Council, and in law school was president of the Yale chapter of the Federalist Society. Then we'll hear from Rob Johnson, who's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, litigating private property, free speech, privacy, and other individual rights cases against local, state, and federal governments. Rob graduated from Columbia and then from Harvard Law School, and he clerked for Judge Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit and Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court. And we're also honored to be joined by Michael Girard, the Andrew Sabin Professor of Professional Practice at Columbia Law School, where he teaches courses on environmental and energy law, so deep expertise in the area we're discussing today. He founded and directs the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law. Before joining the Columbia faculty, he was partner in charge of the New York office of Arnold and Porter. He's a graduate of Columbia and the NYU Law School. So I'm going to let each panelist give a brief, if they want to, brief introduction of the topic as they understand it, and then we'll follow up with a chance for them to respond to each other, moderator-led question and answer time, and then hopefully have some time for questions from the audience before our fabulous ending reception. So with that, Ben, we'd like to hear from you.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I echo everything Judge Mascott said about how wonderful this conference has been, and it's an honor to be here. I guess in my role hitting lead off here, I'd like to just sort of set the table with some insights that might inform the rest of the discussion. One about a misunderstanding of what science is, and another about I think some threats facing the scientific enterprise, at least as it's used in law and public policy these days. So I'll take those in order. The misunderstanding of what science is, I think, is maybe best illustrated with a phrase we've probably all heard quite a bit since maybe 2020 or so, which is trust the science, or I believe in science. And you see that a lot on those signs that also say water is life. It's not a particularly scientific-based statement, but the you know, I think it's important to define our terms. When we talk about science, what exactly is it we're referring to? Science, as I see it at least, and I think I'm right, is not a collection of answers. It's not a collection of truths. It is rather a process that is used for testing, testing hypotheses. So it can certainly inform our understanding of the world. We can try to falsify hypotheses by testing them and seeing if the tests are consistent with or contrary to what we would expect to see. But it's very much not a collection of truths. And I fear that that is often how it's used when it's used in the public policy context. People will say, in COVID, for example, trust the science, meaning schools have to stay shut down. Well, wait a minute. The science can tell us maybe the risks of transmission. It can tell us transmission rates. It can tell us potentially how dangerous, or at least allow us to test how dangerous the virus is. It can allow us to test the efficacy of various safeguards you might put into place to stop the spread of the disease. But it does not answer the public policy question whether schools should be open, or whether oral arguments should be held in person, or any of the other things that we did. And so going back to what science is and what it isn't, it is a way to test hypotheses about the world, to gain knowledge of the way the world operates, and we can certainly use that to inform the public policies that that we decide to adopt. But it is not the only input. It's one. It's an important input, and it's one. But it's one of many. There are others you have to consider. So if we go back to the COVID example, should schools open? Well, we'd also want to consider things like what's the effect on children who are not able to attend school, on their education, on their safety, if they have parents who cannot afford to stay home with them and either lose a job and maybe have food insecurity as a result of that, or face some other hardship. So I think there's almost, I think Adrian Vermeule and others have called it scientism, which is almost a worship of scientific results. And the problem isn't that these people are placing too much faith in science, in my view. The problem is that thinking about what science is in the correct way at all. And if we think about it as a way of, as a tool we can use to learn about the world and inform the choices we make, it's very useful. If we think about it as dictating policy choices, even though it can't measure for many of the variables that go into any given policy choice, I think that's a problem. And now the second point I wanted to briefly touch on before I turn it over to my co-panelists, is I guess a danger facing the scientific community at large, really, but definitely in the public policy context. And that's maybe, again, go back to the definition that I gave. It's a tool that we use to test hypotheses about the world. Now, as I said, it can teach us about the world through those tests that we run, but it can do so only if we're open to the results that we obtain through those tests. And I think we all know that there are certain fields, and we'll get into this more a little bit later, certain fields in the scientific world in which there are certain results that people practicing in that field are not permitted socially, or they might be denied tenure or face other consequences for reaching. So it's great to rely on science to test hypotheses, to learn about the world. However, if you were looking at results in a field where the practitioners of that science are only permitted or only reasonably able to give results on one side of a contested social issue, like climate change, like procedures, gender change procedures for minors, then at that point the science, frankly, is somewhat useless because it's not telling you anything about the world. You're only obtaining the results when they yield the output that the people running the test would like it to yield, which is, again, exactly the opposite of what science is supposed to do, which is test our hypotheses to see if they are, in fact, incorrect. So I hope that sets the table a little bit, first by talking about what science is, and then one way that the process can be warped.
Okay, JJ?
Thank you, Judge Mascot, and thanks for everyone for having me. I'm JJ Snido. I work at Keller Postman, which, if you don't know, is a plaintiff-side firm, so I routinely have the privilege of suing a lot of your clients, and you guys can thank me for the billings on that later. But along the way, we obviously have to litigate a lot of scientific issues in our practice. I want to talk a little bit about Daubert, Rule 702, how that's currently applied. I think that one major achievement of the conservative legal movement in this society in particular is finding ways to cabin the discretion of judges to make the rule of law a law of rules, as Justice Scalia pretty succinctly put it. We've made huge progress of that, of course, in originalism and textualism, and more recently with Loper Bright. But I do think that one area that doesn't get as much of attention where judge discretion is virtually unfettered is the way that we deal with expert witnesses in this country. As many of you know, if you litigate many different types of claims, you often have to put up expert witnesses. As many of you also know, they all have to survive the strictures of Rule 702 and Daubert. I think it's fair to say that the rule doesn't define how a judge should evaluate the reliability of an expert, and the Supreme Court's case law hasn't done a much better job either. Daubert says, no, the job of the judge is not to determine whether the expert's conclusion is correct, but then later Supreme Court cases say that sometimes the judge should take a peek at the conclusions in order to determine if the methods are reliable. That's a hole that you can drive a truck through, and in reality, it means that the judges have discretion to do whatever they so choose in areas that are often complicated, and sometimes they frankly get it wrong. You might know the old trial lawyer saying that the only difference between God and a federal judge is that God doesn't think he's a federal judge. Nowhere do I think that is more true than when a judge is deciding whether an expert's methodology is reliable. I think these concerns become all the more serious the more complicated that the science gets. And of course, it can get quite complicated. I will say, at its best, science deals in experiments. And I think that the real problem for judges and litigators in dealing with these kinds of issues is that outside of certain fields like astrophysics, it's very hard to say what the science or the good science or the best science means. In fields like epidemiology, for example, there is often uncertainty. There's almost always disagreement among actual scientists practicing in the field. There's a famous study where they gave a group of epidemiologists the exact same data totally blinded. They asked them to determine whether they thought there was causation from a certain substance or not, and about half of them said yes, and about half of them said no, and there's no difference between the two groups. I don't think that judges are very good at recognizing this because they think that most fields should operate like astrophysics, but of course that doesn't happen. Apart from certainty, there's almost always embedded judgment calls about policy choices. How much proof should we require that a drug is effective? How much proof should we require that a substance causes a certain disease? We naturally require less proof in certain instances than others, but of course that decision about how much proof to be required is not something that science can answer. It's essentially a policy judgment. For most of the points of scientific contention in law and policy, I submit to you that we can't rely on the way we do things in astrophysics because they're not things on which you can run an experiment. If you drop a ball, it falls down every time. If you throw a ball, it follows the parabolic arc every time. If you combine hydrogen and oxygen, you're going to get water every time. But you can't do that for most of the things that we're currently debating. In an antitrust case, we can't go back in time and figure out how much product would have been sold but for the anti-competitive conduct. We can't go back in time and emit less carbon dioxide as a planet and see if the temperature rises. And of course, we can't randomly expose people to chemicals to see if they develop diseases. So in those situations, I do think it's a mistake to talk about what the science says as a monolith. There's uncertainty, there's disagreement, and again, there's often an implicit policy choice being made. I don't think that's nihilism. It's just a pragmatic recognition that talking about the science is usually an appeal to the opinion of certain people made on incomplete evidence and often laden with value judgments, and I think we'd do better as a court system if we recognize that. I want to give you just one concrete example of this because I think it illustrates the point and it's an interesting story to tell. So as some of you may have heard, smoking has been linked to lung cancer. We do know that now that is true as a country. We did not know that in the 1940s. And I think that there's a folk narrative in our culture that what happened was that there was, in fact, smoking gun evidence, excuse the pun, that this was true. The big bad tobacco companies hid all that evidence from the public. They later got caught, and now we all know that smoking causes lung cancer. The reality is actually a bit more complicated. Since the 1950s, there have been studies showing that people who smoked more did have higher rates of lung cancer. But as you all might have heard, correlation does not equal causation. And so there was pushback. How do we know it's the smoking, people said? How do we know it's not different genetics, different diets, different lifestyles that predispose people to smoke and also get lung cancer? And meanwhile, even the evidence on smoking rates and lung cancer was inconclusive. Those who inhaled seemed to have lower cancer rates, and the data on women who smoked for whatever reason was deeply mixed. So there was pushback. It was a mixed bag. And the pushback, and here's the, I think, part that doesn't get as much attention. The pushback was not just from the big, bad tobacco companies who were big and bad and did a lot of the pushback, but it also came from highly respected epidemiologists in the field. Sir Ronald Fisher, who was a British knight, knighted for being probably the most important statistician in the 20th century, in the 1950s, pushed back hard on the notion that smoking causes lung cancer. And importantly, he did so on scientific grounds. He thought that the level of proof presented from data that was observational, by which I mean simply a correlation, wasn't strong enough in order to justify what he viewed as policy interventions and, frankly, scaremongering. Those disputes back in the 1950s were being made by scientists in good faith. If we were alive in the 1950s, I'm not sure what the press or various factions would have said the good science said on one way or another. And importantly, the only reason that we know now that for sure that smoking causes lung cancer is because we did get an experiment in the form of the fact that people stopped smoking dramatically in this country. The rates of lung cancer later plummeted. That kind of shut the door on the debate. But before that, it absolutely was an open question. So I'll close to you with this. If you're people who care about ordered liberty, if you are interested in limiting unbridled judicial discretion, if you are troubled when you hear people say this is what the science shows without knowing what they're referring to, then I think we would all deserve focusing a little more attention on how expert credibility is evaluated in our courts. Thanks.
All right, thank you, JJ. Now we will hear from Rob.
Thank you, Judge. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Sheldon, for giving us the opportunity to do what I would think of as the mic drop panel here at the end of the conference. You know, I guess like JJ, I'm sort of a plaintiff's lawyer, but a slightly different type of plaintiff's lawyer because I get to sue the government and only the government. You know, when I heard the sort of topic for this panel, you know, should we defer to the experts, or at least that's kind of how I'm thinking of it. My initial immediate reaction was, of course not. You know, I hate the experts, burn them all. We should not defer to them in the slightest. And you know, the reason for that, and this is just, that's just my gut reaction, right? And the reason for that, I think, is two. One is having lived through COVID, right? I think anybody who lived through COVID and hears the phrase, like, trust the experts and just, like, dies a little bit inside, and if you don't, I can't help you. But also, it's just a matter of temperament, you know. So I don't like being told what to think or what to do. That's why I sue the government. So you know. But that being said, you know, obviously there are people out there who have specialized knowledge, who you know, put a lot of work into kind of learning about a field. And, you know, so my kind of gut instinct is, you know, we should listen to those people. They often have things to teach us, but they should be able to explain what they know. And if they can't explain it, then, you know, I'm a bit dubious about it. And I think, you know, if it's something that's really important, it's on all of us to try to work to understand it so that we can evaluate it. And I think, you know, people who are smart and capable people should be able to understand what the experts are saying. And if you can't understand it and you can't evaluate it, I'm suspicious of it. So that's my gut reaction. But after kind of having that immediate reaction, I thought, well, maybe I should be a little careful here because, you know, maybe as somebody who sues the government, it's important actually that maybe sometimes we need to hear from the experts to evaluate, you know, is what the government doing, is it good or not, right? And so I thought, well, maybe I'm being too harsh on the experts. So I decided, you know, I'm going to send out an email to all of my colleagues. I'm going to start cornering them in the hallway and trying to get their opinions. And what I really wanted to do was get a sense from my colleagues at IJ who sue the government of, you know, do we rely on experts to kind of hold the government in check sometimes? And the answer that I got, I think after talking to a bunch of people about this, is no, we don't. You know, the use that we make in our cases of experts typically is to address very limited factual questions. So to give you an example, right now we're suing the city of Norfolk. It's a Fourth Amendment case where we're challenging the use of what are called flock cameras. That these are cameras that are set up all along the roads to monitor, you know, cars. They read the license plates, and they have a big database where they're recording where people are driving. And we say this surveillance, pervasive surveillance system violates the Fourth Amendment. And we do have an expert in that case, but the expert is just basically doing statistical modeling of where all these cameras are located to show that actually, yes, they do follow you around. So we're not saying, you know, trust the experts, defer to the experts. We're just saying, here's an expert who can tell you about the world. They're doing some complicated statistical modeling, but they can explain it to you, and here's how it works. Similarly, in like eminent domain cases, you often have the government saying, hey, like, you know, this area is blighted because the properties are really substandard, and we'll bring in architects, we'll bring in people who are experts in the construction trades, but they're testifying about things that people can understand. On the other hand, you know, the kind of flip side of this is that in our cases, when we're suing the government almost always is coming forward with experts who are not just testifying about the facts in the world, but they're testifying about the ultimate issues in our cases. And they're testifying that, you know, not only, what they're saying is, you know, this government law that you're challenging, it's important, it's necessary. It satisfies strict scrutiny under the First Amendment. We even recently had a case, a Fourth Amendment case, where the government tried to put an expert on the stand to say that a stop and a seizure of somebody on the road, where the police were trying to essentially seize their property through civil forfeiture, that this was a reasonable seizure under the Fourth Amendment, which is like very much, you're not supposed to do that, right? You're not supposed to testify as to the ultimate legal issues as an expert, but in cases where you're litigating against the government, that's the kind of use you see made of experts all the time. The really interesting thing to me, though, in talking to my colleagues was how often, when the government is putting forward experts to try to defend challenged actions or challenged laws, when we have the opportunity to depose experts, it turns out that they just fall apart. And that's something I think that's also really revealing. And I think it goes to this question of, should we just defer to the experts? And just to give a couple examples, right? So we have a case it was down in Texas. We were representing a veterinarian who is a First Amendment case where he was saying, I just want to send emails to people to give them veterinary advice. And the state of Texas said, if you can't send people emails giving them veterinary advice unless you've seen the animal in person first. And he wanted to give advice to people who, some of them were in completely different continents, and he wasn't able to see them in person. So we sued, we brought a First Amendment case, and we actually won that case in the Fifth Circuit. But the reason it's relevant is the state put forward an expert who was saying, because he hasn't examined these animals, he's giving all this bad advice. And so this expert purported to go through all of advice and say, this is bad advice, this is bad advice. So we deposed this expert, and we actually took the expert who the state was putting out there forward. It was a veterinarian who had a radio call-in show. The expert had their own radio. So we took things that this expert had said on their own call-in show, and we put them into emails that were purportedly, from our client, the veterinarian who wants to send emails. And we showed the expert these emails during the deposition and said, is this bad advice? And the expert said, yeah, that's terrible advice. I think you often have experts who are, they're just not, they're trying to reach a foregone conclusion. And we also see in our cases, I think, a lot where experts are just, they're testifying or opining on something that is just ultimately not the right question. So another First Amendment case where we're trying to uphold the right of counselors to do therapy across state lines. And there was somebody who testified that, we really need to have licensing of therapists. But then when you depose them, it's like, well, yeah, but actually they should be able to talk across state lines. And that actually would be really great and really helpful and is going to help patients. They basically ended up supporting our case. One final point, and before I turn it back, beyond the question of whether experts are correct or acting in good faith, there's also just, we don't know it, unless we are able to probe it, whether government policy is really based on expertise. And often we see that government will claim that it's making policy based on the sort of opinions of experts, but then it turns out that's not the case. So just one final example. We have had a case in Wisconsin challenging a restriction on selling cottage food. This means like food that people cook in their own kitchens. And we sued saying that, this is violated the Wisconsin state constitution. And the government in response says, it would just be a terrible health crisis if people could sell food made in their own kitchens. And it's just going to be terrible. All sorts of disease will result. And the case went to discovery, and we deposed the state's own expert, the sort of agency expert. And the agency expert said, no, it'd be fine. It'd be totally fine. So, the government may say the experts are saying something, but you don't really know until you ask.
Okay, thank you very much. Professor... Professor Girard, did you want to respond?
Yes, thank you. We shouldn't automatically trust all science. Skepticism is very helpful, but we shouldn't automatically dismiss it either. If the science has gone through rigorous peer review, is based on data, and has been gone through lots of processes, we should take it very seriously. The extent to which we should take it seriously, of course, depends in part on who's paying for it. If we have experts who are paid by the litigators on one side, I would treat that somewhat less reverentially than if it comes from some other source. But in terms of the relationship between science and public policy, in my own field, environmental law, the statutes tend to be clear on where science governs and where other factors are relevant. So under the Clean Air Act, the statute is clear that the determination of whether a pollutant should be regulated is based purely on science. Then how you regulate it is subject to a whole lot of other issues. Whether a species should be counted as an endangered species is based entirely on the science, according to the statute. But what you do about it is subject to a lot of other considerations. The same with the regulation of toxic substances and many other things. So I think it's important to distinguish where science really is determinative, at what point in the process is it determinative, and at what point are other factors relevant. And I think we sometimes mix those up. Let me just say on the suggestion that that scientists who are run counter to the accepted wisdom can't get tenure or otherwise rejected. My experience in the last 16 years working in a university, as opposed to my prior 30 years in practice, is that the way to get ahead is to disrupt the accepted understanding. James Watson just died. Watson and Crick discovered the DNA. It completely disrupted what had been the understanding of biology, but they won the Nobel Prize. The way to get ahead in science in many areas is to be contrary to what the accepted wisdom is. Now, you have to back it up. You will be met with skepticism appropriately, but if you are able to back it up with data and theory and everything else, then that will be, that is really very positive. That is the way to get ahead. That is a good way to get tenure. The final thing I want to mention is that there are lots of anecdotes about bad experts. I have some anecdotes I could come up with myself from my years in practice, but that shouldn't be taken as being representative. We shouldn't generalize from the anecdotes that we have. There are certainly bad examples of almost everything. There are some bad lawyers out there, but I think we need to look at what the broad scope of what, where is expertise available? How do you test it? How do you determine its reliability? And that, I'm afraid, sometimes doesn't happen to the extent that it should.
Okay, thank you all for those interesting or introductory comments, and there's a lot to unpack. And so I want to just kind of pose some open-ended questions and give you all room to respond and engage in cross-conversation. I guess my first question is, I feel like you all raised a lot of interesting policy arguments on both sides about what might be some potential pitfalls of science. What could the benefits be? Maybe we don't want to throw it out too quickly. But as a matter of law, what do we do in our system if there's an instruction? And do we think there are sometimes just instructions to consider science? So if I can take a concrete example from the case that Ben Flowers was involved in litigating, the OSHA vaccine case, there was actually a statutory provision that ended up having to be interpreted in the case that gave the secretary emergency authority if he determined employees are exposed to grave danger from substances determined to be toxic or physically harmful. That was one of the provisions. Now, there were obviously a lot of other contextual issues in the case, but you might just say as a superficial matter, the reference to grave danger. How is one supposed to unpack that if one doesn't interpret grave danger? What's the fact that goes into making that determination? And who is the actor who's supposed to be determining whether there's a grave danger and therefore emergency regulatory authority?
So I guess I'll start since I was involved in the case. But look, I think in so there are some statutes where it's very clear, and Professor Girard gave some of them. Like in the Clean Air Act, if it says when the parts per million exceed a certain threshold, the you know, the pollutant must be regulated. And obviously that's just a measure, and it's a pretty quantitative thing that's either a yes or a no. But with something like grave danger, it really is a qualitative decision that no doubt science can inform. But I don't think there's, it's not like you can test for grave danger. You're testing for something else and then making a policy judgment about whether there's a grave danger. And I think in our separation of powers, it's healthy to have all three branches involved there. So Congress, of course, passes the law, gives the ability to the executive, questionably in my view, to make the determination in the first instance whether there's a grave danger, and then that can be challenged, and Congress created a process for challenging that through the courts. And ultimately, it's a legal determination of whether they've made the requisite showing. And under the Administrative Procedure Act other statutes that operate in a similar way, there's room for litigants to challenge not only the interpretation of the words, but the analysis itself that goes into the agency's decision making. So in that case, for example, there were very serious, first of all, if there's anyone in here looking for tenure, I went back through and getting ready for this this presentation and looked at the OSHA rule, and there's all kinds of predictions in there that I think it'd be interesting to know how many actually bore out, because what they were predicting was if the mandate didn't go into effect, you know, the world would come to an end, and we're still here. But you could look at like the internal consistency of the reasoning. So for example, they said in the rule, they said, and I went back and looked at my oral argument outline. This was really fun to do actually. But there was a reference that said nobody who takes the vaccine is in grave danger, right? However, their own studies that they were relying on showed that elderly people who were vaccinated were still at significantly higher danger than unvaccinated people who were younger. So if those old people are vaccinated and they're not in grave danger anymore, necessarily the younger people who are unvaccinated are not either. I was very fortunate in litigating that case to have she was a deputy for me at the time. She's now the current Ohio Solicitor General, Mathra Sridharan. And Mathra's great for many reasons, but one of them is she has two science degrees from MIT. I do not. Yeah. So when I was, all this happened on a very tight timeline. So while I was prepping for oral argument while drafting the reply brief, so there's a lot going on, and I didn't have time to get into the scientific studies, and I couldn't have understood them if I did, but Mathra could. So I would send them to her and say, can you help me understand what this is about? And she had this whole spreadsheet of problems with each studies that I was, you know, if it came up at argument, I'd be ready to go through. And there were things we found that, for example, some of these studies said, you know, to get to the 95% confidence interval that scientists lie or that a lot of people want for their studies, they would have to say something like, being unvaccinated increases your rate of death by a lot. Well, how much? Well, if to get to the 95% confidence interval, somewhere between 11 and 81 times. That's a gigantic gap that has obvious consequences for the question whether there's a grave danger. So I guess that was all a long way of answering your question, but there's the legal question of what does grave danger mean, but there's also a role for litigators and courts to play in assessing, are you even, is the internal logic of the decision that the executive branch is making coherent? And in that case, I think it pretty clearly wasn't.
All right, thank you for that. And does anybody want to add to that or respond? Professor Girard?
I'll just say that it is always helpful to be able to look back and see whether the predictions bore out. That's the best test. For instance, in the realm of climate change, it turns out that the predictions that were made 20 and 30 years ago about future sea level rise and future average global temperatures were spot on, that they were remarkably accurate going back, the predictions going back decades. That, I think, is verification that the science that is used is valid. Now, there are a lot of uncertainties, but I think there are some things that we now know with a sufficient degree of confidence that we can rely on it until some important contrary evidence comes up, which hasn't.
Thank you. Rob, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, so it seems to me that especially with the APA context, right, that there's this question kind of points at an interesting question, which is after Loeb or Bright, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure that gets put on the idea of deference to agency expertise. And, you know, one thing I worry about is that we're going to see agencies saying, okay, you don't have to defer to us qua agencies, but you have to defer to us because we're the experts. And You know, I think it's important to push back on that. And I think that, you know, the APA says that agency action can't be arbitrary and capricious. And what that means, it has to be reasonable and reasonably explained. And I think this kind of goes to what I said earlier, that, experts, you know, obviously there's value in expert knowledge, but only is so insofar as experts are able to explain it. And that's what the APA, I think, correctly understood requires.
So just to follow up on that, and then JJ, if you want to jump in, but if we're not deferring to the experts, though, in that instance, does that mean the courts end up themselves making the scientific determination? And are they better equipped institutionally to do it?
I mean, so it's a great question. I think the answer in the APA context is no, right? But I think that the courts need
to look. Well, no, in what sense? No, courts are not supposed to be doing the scientific determination?
No, so I don't think the courts are going to be, you can't possibly have courts themselves sort of being scientists, right? Like that's not realistic and it's not going to happen. But I think, you know, the APA suggests that the courts need to look at what the agency is saying, including the agency's experts, and ask, is this reasonable and reasonably explained? So, you know, I think that's not a blank check for the agency. I think the agency has to explain what it's doing. And so, you know, it's one thing, you know, the court is not going to decide what does the science say, but I think the court can look at the science and say, does this make sense? Is what I'm being told by the agency, does it make sense?
So in your understanding of how the APA standard would work, and I welcome anybody to jump in, because I know this is like a core separation of powers component to how expertise or science comes up, but if the question is whether an action's arbitrary or capricious, essentially the default would be the agency, once it's challenged, can't act unless it demonstrates that there's a reasonable basis and it's not arbitrary or capricious. Is that how you all read the review scheme to work there? And Professor Gerard, I'd be interested if you have thoughts.
Can I just, we hear a lot about Loper-Bright, of course, which concerns where the courts told us that we should not defer to the interpretation of the agency, by the agency of its statute. But that's much different from the interpretation of the agency of facts. And so there was an important NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act decision written by Justice Kavanaugh in June called Seven County Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County, in which the court said that we should defer to the expertise of the agency in making these scientific judgments. That issue, that case concerned what would be the appropriate content of an environmental impact statement under NEPA. But it was an interesting finding that there should be deference to agency expertise on factual issues. Now, it's not an unbreakable deference. Obviously, the other side can try to knock it down, and maybe they will be successful, but the starting point is to give this kind of deference to the scientific expertise.
Rob, Jay, did you all want to respond?
Yeah, so, you know, the NEPA case is, as I read the NEPA case, it says it turns very much on the NEPA statute, right? The court said that NEPA is a purely procedural statute and that it doesn't impose any kind of substantive limitation on the agency, which I think, you know, makes sense because this is in the context, right, of agencies wanting to do things themselves and having to go through certain procedures. Whereas, you know, a lot of cases are where the agencies are regulating people in the public and actually limiting people's activity in a way that you know, NEPA doesn't involve. And in those cases, often the statutes are not purely procedural, they're substantive. And they say the agency action has to be reasonable, or it has to be necessary, or reasonably necessary, or there's all kinds of other sort of substantive terms in there, right? And in that context, you know, the court is not going to put itself in the shoes of the agency, but the agency's explanation of why something is reasonable or necessary, it has to hang together. And it has to be reasonably explained. And so, you know, and I think that's true whether it's based on agency expertise or not.
JJ?
I've got no expertise on the admin law, but on the question you asked, Judge, I have a fairly deep skepticism that you can know what the science says, even at the level of basic facts. Again, outside of certain fields, mostly in the hard sciences, but certainly when it comes to the life sciences, the level of evidence often leads to results that are inconclusive. And I am troubled with the phrase "the science shows," because when people hear that, they think that means the science shows it in the sense that science shows that the moon goes around the Earth every month. And it's nowhere near the same process, much less the same level of certainty. The best example I can think of this is Scrimeti. I don't know if you all have had the occasion to read the amicus briefs in that case. If you haven't, you absolutely should. We heard from the federal government for years that the science shows for sure these treatments were absolutely necessary. A bunch of people decided to double click on those studies a little bit and file amicus briefs. And it turns out that, of course, the level of certainty wasn't very good at all, much less what the government was saying. In these types of fields, I think the potential for mischief and politicization is also quite high, because you are forced to make judgments about policy outcomes and about what level of certainty you're going to expect. There's no way escaping the fact that would require judgment. That can get politicized, and again, I'll refer you to the Scrimeti briefs. I mean, the discovery that was revealed for what went into the worldwide expert consensus leaves a lot to be desired, and I think we should all be on guard against it.
Can I briefly add? I do want to. I think a lot of this is important to stress is very much like a second best way of handling things, because you're asking, should it be the executive or the judicial? And I think the answer is they both are analyzing this, and there's a check on each. But I mean, I have this radical idea that before Americans are subject to a rule based on science, it could be like maybe one house of Congress proposes a bill, and then they pass it, and then it goes to the Senate, and they pass it, and then maybe there's the president maybe gets to look and see if he thinks it should be signed into law or not. And I think maybe we could have a setup like that, and that would be the best way of all of incorporating science into rulemaking. And there'd be the virtue of being a lot. Now, don't clap too much, because there'd be a lot less rules and a lot less need for those of us in this room to litigate these cases.
But you would then prefer Congress not to have the open-ended terms that then kind of delegate essentially the.
Yeah, I think I actually think constitutionally Congress can't do that. And I think I stand with Madison on that. I don't think it's too crazy. But I realize they have, and the court's not going to do anything about it. So I'm not saying we need to go into court and make that argument that has no chance of success every single time. But I do feel a need to give some shout out to the actual Constitution.
All right. That's good. So moving us back up to kind of a more meta level or large scale question, I mean, dealing with science in general, do you all see the role of science having significantly changed in our system and our reliance on it over the last 10 to 20 years? And are there trends that are positive in that maybe we're relying on it less for those of you who disapprove of it, or troubling trends? Like, how do you see it moving? And what should we be looking for in the future with the role of science?
Is that to me?
Anybody.
Okay. I'll start. I do think that science at its best is based on experiment, but you can't obviously just throw up your hands and say you're going to do nothing. I think as a society, we do need to realize that given the level of certainty of evidence that we have, that you're going to have to make different policy judgments. You know, to take some concrete examples, if a drug is going to be approved as a last-ditch effort for cancer, I'd be willing to tolerate slightly less certainty that it's going to be effective than a drug that's given as a cold medication. That's just obviously a policy judgment, and I think we're doing a disservice not to recognize that. Would you ask how it's evolved over the past?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not to be a broken record, but I do think recently there has been a very troubling trend of debates that are that should be framed as policy disagreements being framed as one side is pro science and one side's pro other, pro not science. And part of that is, I think, for me, driven by my pretty deep skepticism that there's much certainty outside of a few specialized fields.
Okay. Others of you want to talk about trends? Rob?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know if this is a trend or not, but the thing that I see is that, you know, there's just a movement towards viewing science being presented as a conclusion rather than as a process, and that science is being, we're being told what the answer is, but not how people got there. And I think that that, you know, is societally not great, but especially in the courts, right? There's, I think, the sort of longstanding idea that experts are, can offer their opinions, they can offer their expertise, but they don't testify to ultimate issues, right? And I think what that's kind of getting at is that you should be able to understand from the, you know, the expert can testify and tell you what they know, but they should also explain it in a way that you can understand. And I think it, we're kind of getting to a point sometimes it feels like where asking for the explanation and then questioning the thought process is like, well, you aren't qualified to do that. And I think that's worth pushing back on that, you know, if you're an, you know, and maybe this has something to do with the kind of decline of generalism in our society generally, right? That like nobody's a generalist anymore. So if it's outside your kind of little niche, you're not qualified to talk about it. And I just think that's something to push back on, that, you know, if you're a smart person, that you're qualified to opine on things, even if they're not in your area of expertise.
Well, when new hazards emerge, whether they're chemicals or viruses or technologies or whatever, the government needs to make a judgment about what to do about it. And there are often considerable degrees of uncertainty, but that's one area where the notice and comment process is very effective, that it's an invitation for people to put forth their views, their data, their judgments about it, and then the agency can make a decision. And the agencies need to be given some deference to do that, but it's not as if they're just saying this is what the truth is and nobody can say anything about it. They are opening it up for comment from everybody who wants to comment, and you get a lot of comments in all of these technical rulemaking, so that the agency, and if you can look among them and figure out who they think is right, and then if it's challenged in court, the courts can decide whether it's arbitrary and capricious. But we do have a process for testing the science before it becomes part of policy.
I guess my thought on the current use of it is I agree with a lot of what's been said. What I would add is there are, it at least seems to me, an increasing number of areas, fields within the scientific community in which it's not okay to challenge the orthodoxy. So I agree, in large part, you make your name by disrupting the sort of general consensus. And I have no reason to doubt that that's still true in astrophysics or in chemistry or in most, you know, biological fields, and maybe even in medicine. But there are subsets of those areas where I think we have pretty good reason to think it's not true. JJ referenced the amicus briefs in Scrimeti. I'd refer you in particular to the one that Alabama filed, which Justice Thomas cites quite a bit in his concurrence. But what you'll see there is in the area relating to gender transition procedures for minors, whether it's puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones, anyone who expressed skepticism of the sort of mainstream view that we should be administering these treatments to children, I use treatments loosely, to children, was shouted down. And indeed, worse than that, there were scientists, doctors within that community who openly said they did not publish results that didn't reveal, that didn't yield the sorts of outcomes they liked or that were helpful to the cause, because they would hurt the cause. And so it's a real danger to science and scientific inquiry. If we actually care about science, and I do, and we want it to be useful, we can't say that there are certain conclusions that are off limits, that are politically incorrect, or anything like that. We have to be open to whatever the scientific process actually yields. And I think it's disturbing that that brief makes very, very clear that was at least one field in which that was not true, and it led to an untold amount of harm to many, many children throughout this country, and throughout the world, really.
So thank you. So I just have one more question, and then I have one more question following up on some of this discussion, and then we'll open it up to the audience. But building on the Scrimeti opinion and case and Justice Thomas's concurrence, as you reference, there's a lot of rich analysis in Justice Thomas's separate writing, but one of his statements is the views of self-proclaimed experts do not shed light on the meaning of the Constitution. So he's expressing skepticism, obviously, about the use and the role of science and expertise in our understanding or definitive interpretation of the law. I know that, Ben, you in particular expressed skepticism that we're going to really see a tightening of the standard and the accountability for the use of science and for Congress delegating policymaking decisions to agencies. But do you all think that perhaps Justice Thomas's statement here in combination with some of the things that we saw as a society in terms of the constraint on liberty and freedom and just the significant impact after COVID of scientific decisions in terms of our choices on a daily basis, that will over the years start to take hold and perhaps lead to rethinking about a knee-jerk deference to scientific expertise and maybe give some room for accountability moving forward?
I'm skeptical because I think for a lot of people it's a useful cudgel. To me it's not so much a matter of deferring less to the scientists or the results of their tests. It's more maybe giving them deference that I trust you that the test says this, but that doesn't dictate the public policy we should adopt in light of that test. We need to also consider other costs and benefits that are maybe impacted by this, maybe not, but it's not the sole criterion that should inform the policy development. I hope we get there, but I'm not, it seems like people are, frankly, on all sides, like when they get a scientific study they like, they love to be able to say, no, you're the one who's anti-science, when we should all be pro-science, meaning we should all account for what the results of these tests are telling us, but we shouldn't just assume that whatever policy that conclusion most aligns with is the one we must adopt. We have to be well-rounded people, generalists, who can look not only at the science, but at economic considerations and other considerations, and factor all that into the policy we adopt. I don't know if I answered your question. I'm not terribly optimistic. But.
Other thoughts?
I have to say, I'm not a fan of Justice Thomas's concurrence in that case. It seems to me that he moved from skepticism to dismissiveness. He was really suggesting not only should we always look behind, look under the wheels and see what was actually the case, but he seemed to be talking about self-described experts and so forth, and there are a lot of experts who are not just self-described, but are accepted through a rigorous process. I mean, I'll give you an example. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change goes through a rigorous peer review process and through a public review process. And I did a count. The IPCC has been cited in 436 decisions in courts of the United States and 370 decisions in courts outside the United States. I haven't been able to find a single one that found that cast doubt on the IPCC's findings. When you have something that is so broadly accepted, not only by science, but by courts all over the world, all over the country and all over the world, I think that's entitled to deference. That is not to say that you should not be able to question it. You always should be able to question it. But when something achieves that level of acceptance, I think that it does deserve a considerable amount of deference. And these are not self-appointed scientists. These are thousands of scientists all around the world who engage in vigorous peer review and have come to these conclusions, many of which have been confirmed by the observational evidence over a period of decades.
Any other thoughts?
When I hear people say study show, my hackles go up. Even when Kristen Wagner said this morning a study show something, I kind of said, well, I'd like to see those studies. I don't think appealing to peer review is a get out of jail free card on this, because the peers are other experts in the relevant field. And if the relevant field either isn't epistemologically capable of showing certain conclusions, or if the field isn't certain, or if the field, shall we say, is politically compromised, I'm not that persuaded by the fact of peer review. Again, at bottom, I think what I dislike least about the appeal to the science is that people think you're talking about physics. Like, see, like that will happen every single time. But when we're talking about any of the things that actually get litigated in our courts and certainly with public policy, it's always far more complicated. And the appeal to authority, which is always going to be an appeal to certain types of experts, I think is a bad one.
I mean, so I'm not going to comment on the that debate, but I will say into the question of whether there's we should be optimistic that people will defer less to experts. I mean, I'm always an optimist, so, you know, it's temperamentally. So maybe, you know, I'd push back on what Ben said just a tiny bit there. I think that we have seen, you know, with COVID and with other events in recent years that, you know, there maybe is some movement in our society to question this idea that, you know, you're just going to have the expert conclusion handed to you on a plate and that that's just the end of the discussion. And I think I'm optimistic that people will take some kind of lesson from that. Maybe that makes me wrong, but.
Right. Thank you. All right. So do we have any questions from the audience?
Thank you, Jennifer. Is this microphone working? Yes.
Yes.
I'm Roger Pilon with the Cato Institute, and I'm going to put to the panel a case where deference to the experts had perverse consequences. We've heard a lot about reason and reasoning and the reason of science. I'm reminded of, I think it was David Hume, who observed that the love of reason is among the faintest of man's passions. And the case is Abigail Alliance. Some of you may remember it. A young woman, 21 years old, suffered from a rare form of neck cancer. And there was a promising drug from the FDA that she asked to avail herself of. And her doctor supported that. But of course, she was denied that. She appealed. Doug Ginsburg wrote an opinion defending her. It went on bank, and the on bank court reversed. She eventually died of that cancer. The drug proved shortly thereafter to be efficacious in that very form of cancer. And so here is a case among many whereby we deferred to the experts and we therefore denied her the proposition, whose life is it anyway?
Thank you, Roger. So do we have, and we have probably time for a couple more, because I know Dean's going to come up and close us out a little bit early, but are there questions that folks have for the panelists on either side? Take from this microphone next.
So yes, my name is David Tryon. I'm with the Buckeye Institute in Ohio. So we file a lot of amicus briefs. I've read a lot of amicus briefs. Amicus briefs often submit information, statistical information, scientific information. We talk about Scarmetti, but we also say, well, we need to cross-examine these experts. Well, these amicus briefs are never cross-examined, the experts that submit that. They're not subject to cross-examination. It's not in the record, but the court still relies on it. So should the court rely on amicus briefs that are not part of the record and have not been subject to cross-examination? I'm interested in your thoughts.
Okay, so what do the panelists think about the role of amicus briefs in unpacking expertise?
I mean, of course, it depends on what they're saying. It'll probably be no surprise for you to hear from me that if I were a judge, I would read with great skepticism anything in an amicus brief about what scientific consensus the science and so on shows.
Yeah, so I think one thing that I kind of drew from, you know, talking to my colleagues and sort of hearing about the, you know, how this plays out in our cases so often is that the adversarial process is actually a really great way to test claims of scientific expertise. And so, yeah, I mean, I think if something's in an amicus brief and it's not being subjected to that kind of testing, I think there's reason to be skeptical of it. You know, obviously then there's like the APA context where like you don't have any, in an APA case, you don't have any, you know, you can't depose the agency in an APA type case. But even there, you know, I think that just to have these kind of untested claims is both kind of probably legally not relevant under the APA and also just something courts should be careful of.
I agree with all that with the caveat that they should defer heavily to mine.
Professor Gerard.
I'd want to know who paid for it, as with so much evidence, the judge will take it for whatever it's worth and will judge its credibility. They won't automatically accept it, but they'll read it, they'll understand where it comes from, they'll see if there are opposing amicus briefs and make a judgment about how much to believe it.
All right, thank you. One more question from this side, and then we're going to turn us over to Dean.
All right, thanks. Just a quick question. I mean, probably mostly for Professor Gerard, but really for any of you. In Michigan versus EPA, the Supreme Court held that EPA is required to take the cost of its decisions into account before promulgating any final rule. And, you know, similarly, under the Administrative Procedure Act, all agencies are required to engage in informed rulemaking. And it's challenging for me to see how an obligated or potentially obligated party would be able to meaningfully be able to discuss its obligations under a proposal if you actually simply separated the technical question of whether something, you know, qualifies under the Clean Air Act or anything from the subsequent actual agency actions. So I guess my question for you would be if you're making that argument that the Clean Air Act or other statutes reserve some things as being purely technical questions, and you separate those technical questions from the qualitative judgments and obligations that come from that, how do you sort of square that with both, I guess, EPA's specific obligations under Michigan versus EPA and with an agency's general obligations under the Administrative Procedure Act? Thank you.
Well, if you're talking about the Michigan versus EPA decision concerning the mercury standard for air pollution, a major issue there was to what extent do you consider just the impacts of one pollutant as opposed to combined pollutants. And the science can inform about what that combined impact does, but there was fundamentally a legal issue about whether it is permissible to look at all those pollutants together. And that was a judgment that the courts made. And I think that's the appropriate role for the courts to decide whether it was legally permissible to consider these pollutants together. Having the information about what the combined effect was a scientific question, but whether that was legally appropriate was a job for the courts.
Any other thoughts to hop onto that?
Yeah, well, so the Michigan v. EPA case, the Supreme Court said that, I think this is what Trevor was getting at, the agency is in deciding, in the statute there, I think said that regulation had to be necessary or reasonably necessary or something along those lines. And the Supreme Court said that you can't make that determination purely on the basis of science. You have to also consider, the costs of the regulatory action to the people who are being regulated and whether those costs outweigh the benefits. And the agency just hadn't considered that, right? And it wasn't that the court said, we're going to decide ourselves whether the costs are worth it or not, but the agency has to consider that, and then their explanation of why the costs are worth it has to be reasonable. That partly turned on the language of the statute, and it partly turned on the sort of arbitrary and capricious requirement of the APA. And yeah, I think that's right. You can't, agencies, and this is kind of what Ben was saying, right? So agencies aren't just making scientific decisions, they're making policy decisions, and they have to explain those decisions.
Okay, well, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Judge Mascot, and thank you, panelists. That was terrific. During the convention, I am often asked how I think things are going and what my favorite part of the convention is. I sketched out these remarks this morning. I was going to say my favorite part of the convention is you, the members, the attendees. But then Sheldon surprised Lee and me with that wonderful tribute and those lovely words. So that is now my favorite part of the convention. I'm kidding, of course. You guys are still my favorite part of the convention. I've said this before, but you really are the Federalist Society. You, the members in this room, in the hallways, watching from your homes and offices, you are the heart and soul of the organization, and you're the reason we do all this. You're the reason the staff undertakes these extraordinary measures to make sure you have a great experience. So take another moment to thank the staff, if you could. I also love the fact that you guys show up in such great numbers, and the word numbers reminds me of a story. This will be very brief. This happened at a recent staff meeting, and we were, as a staff, trying to determine how many items we had on our entire website of a certain thing. And our tech people were there, and they were able to tell us, there's 28 per page. And I said, how many pages? And they said, 20. And I said, 560. And the staff looked at me like I was a witch. Because lawyers don't do math. And Sheldon said, nerd. So we have fun on staff, but I love the fact that we use numbers and we're able to determine that you guys showed up in record amounts this year. Thursday, yes, applaud yourselves. The Thursday dinner, of course, sold out before it's advertised. Thursday sold out, Friday sold out, Saturday sold out. And it is my greatest hope coming out of the convention that you feel as engaged and as motivated as I do, and that we continue this journey together with renewed energy and relentless resolve ever forward. Don't forget to sign out for CLE as you leave. Please join us at our closing reception. We've added an open bar. It's in the Heights courtyard, just off the lobby level. And I'm going to have to ask you to exit as quickly as possible through the back doors on the right. Did I mention the open bar? The back doors on the right, that's the way out. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.